Good morning. Thank you all for coming, but we have a special welcome to Barneveld High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. And we have students from Globe University. Would they stand, please? Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students to come and listen to an oral argument. We send them materials about the case. They may engage in activities relating to the court or the case. And then at noon, after the second oral argument, a justice assigned for the day meets with the students and anyone else who wishes to come. Everyone is welcome. The discussion centers on procedure. That is how we take a case, how we decide cases, write opinions, and distribute, circulate the opinions. The discussion does not center on the substantive issues of the cases that the court hears. So we welcome you all to that. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you would raise your hand, the marshal can give you a summary. Anyone want a summary? Right. Now that we've met you, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. This is the justice who will be assigned today to meet with you. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, and the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case today, State versus Dean M. Blatterman, 2013 AP 2107 CR. David Perlman, Assistant Attorney General, has 25 minutes to argue. Jonas Bednarek, thank you, who represents Dean Blatterman, has 30 minutes, and then Attorney Perlman has 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, Mr. Perlman.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good morning, Justices. Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, in the main, turns on the totality of the circumstances. Facts either way can change the calculus. Keeping that in mind, let us for the moment put ourselves in Deputy Nicias's shoes in this case. Nicias, a 19-year police veteran, as the saying goes, this was not his first rodeo. He was experienced. He is armed. He is pointing his weapon.
Where does that saying come from?
I think you made it up.
Well, no, I'd like to take the pleasure of making it up.
Right. Probably at some rodeo somewhere.
Yes. I was anticipating questions that the court might postulate.
You knew
that's
why
I asked you, Mr. Perlman.
Not first in my list. But.
You need not answer it then, and you can use it when you give your talks.
Okay.
I think it'll amuse the audience, too. Go ahead.
Officer Nicias is armed. He is pointing his weapon. He is confronting Blatterman after stopping Blatterman's vehicle. This is what Nicias knows at this time. Blatterman's wife had complained that Blatterman was trying to draw gas into their home either through a stove or a fireplace. She had complained that he was perhaps attempting to draw carbon monoxide into the home, to try to blow the home up. She mentioned that Blatterman might be intoxicated and that Blatterman in the past had referenced suicide by cop, Suicide by cop is a very frightening aspect for a police officer. It's a very unfair bargain. The subject gets, sadly, but what they seemingly want is death, while the officer is left with the collateral damage of trauma, gore, and guilt. Sadly, it's not a rare concept. That's why the phrase was coined. Nicias is called for backup. He is making what he interprets to be a high-risk stop. He commands Blatterman to show his hands, his empty hands, through the car window. Blatterman does not do this. Instead, against orders, he gets out of his car. In freezing mid-March weather, he is wearing a T-shirt and jeans and starts walking towards the police with his hands raised and carrying something. He is commanded to stop. But this person, believed to have referenced suicide by cop, this person who had allegedly recently been engaged in erratic and potentially dangerous behavior at his home, keeps ignoring the command, keeps walking toward the police. This is the factual context from where our Fourth Amendment inquiry begins. Eventually, Platterman, conceitedly against his wishes, is transported to a local hospital 10 miles away. Clearly, this transport is a seizure. Clearly, this transport is a Fourth Amendment event. In the circumstances that I described, and from others that developed during the initial investigation, the state submits that there were two justifications for moving Blatterman. One, the movement was permissible in general since the police had probable cause to arrest Blatterman for a PAC violation, a man who, due to three prior OWI convictions.
When did the officers know that it was a three prior convictions?
The record reflects that the officer did not know this at the moment that I described it to you, Chief, but that they knew this before the transport.
Before the transport?
Before the transport.
When was he arrested?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that it was not a formal arrest during the decision to transport. He was handcuffed. He was in the squad. For purposes of justification, the state believes that that is an arrest or an alternative, as I will discuss, community caretaker concern. But before the transport, the police were clearly aware of his prior driving record.
Okay. But handcuffing him, putting him in the squad car, I assume a reasonable person would not think that he could leave.
I think that's a fair presumption to make. It does not necessarily make it an arrest, but we would train the police that if they were to do that, they would advise the subject that he is not under arrest and give the subject the rationale for the handcuffing. There are cases that suggest that a handcuffed person is not necessarily arrested. In this case, I felt the handcuffing was proper for the primary reason of the factual context from which this relationship developed. Also, the handcuffing seemed to be necessary because he had not responded to police commands, that he appeared not to be completely with the program as far as the police were concerned, and they were concerned as well as for his safety.
I don't see any problem with that, doing the handcuff. I mean, I'm not saying that was not legitimate. I'm saying when was he arrested? Because it's at the time of arrest that you have to have probable cause, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So that's why I want to pinpoint it, and that's why I wanted to pinpoint when he knew, when the officers knew it was three, because three prior convictions, because that's brings in .02, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. Okay. I think I understand your question now. Mm-hmm. My answer would be this. I think initially we have a Terry-type situation for which the handcuffing and placement in the squad is perfectly legitimate. I think it developed into an arrest setting after he had observed the odor of an intoxicant in his breath, after he had observed the watery eyes, after he had checked that information with the previous information that the wife had said that he might be intoxicated, and his lack of response to commands, and his rather inappropriate attire for the weather. And when the transport came, the Terry stop justification no longer works because they took him, in my view, too far away, and that he was arrested. So I would say he became arrested once the transport took him beyond the immediate vicinity.
Two small things, counsel. First, you said that there are cases that suggest that the handcuffing does not necessarily equate to an arrest. However, I mean, the cases are clear. They hold that. It doesn't, there's not just a suggestion, there's holding, which I call it a small thing because I know you know that.
I appreciate your confidence in my knowledge. And yes, I was just hedging.
That's one small thing. The second is, once it was made clear to him that he was going to be transported to a hospital, did they offer him a choice of where to go? And if so, what did he say?
Yes, they did offer him a choice of where to go, and I'm not in any way suggesting he wanted to go.
Right.
But they asked him what hospital he was most familiar or comfortable with, and the one he picked was the one they went to.
St. Mary's.
St. Mary's.
All right.
10 miles away.
Is that significant in terms of the ruling both by the circuit court and the opposite ruling by the Court of Appeals?
The fact that they took him to a hospital that he preferred?
Yes.
I would say that it's consistent with reasonableness. When you have a community caretaker discussion, you're looking at the reasonableness, at the alternative options. And when you have a distance involved, you want to pick one that meets what he prefers and is reasonable in terms of distance. So in the reasonableness discussion, I think it would be relevant.
Where does the issue of vicinity, action within the vicinity, come from?
And this is what makes this case interesting. It was litigated at the trial court level primarily under a Terry stop analysis. At that time, the state to prevail had to justify a movement of 10 miles. The test, as is established in Cortana and its progeny, is that you have to prove two things. One, that the movement was in the vicinity, and two, the decision to move was reasonable. In this case, I believe the state was strong on the reasonableness, but had problems on vicinity because it was 10 miles. Cortana was 1 mile. There's an unpublished opinion that says 4 miles is as far as we're going to take it. In my view, 10 miles is a long way to fit within the vicinity discussion.
But the vicinity comes from 968.24, doesn't it? Temporary questioning without arrest. And it says, after having identified himself as a law enforcement officer, a law enforcement officer may stop a person in a public place. This is a Terry stop.
Right.
For a reasonable period of time, when the officer reasonably suspects such person is about to commit or has committed a crime, and may demand the name and address of the person and an explanation of the conduct. Such detention and temporary questioning shall be conducted in the vicinity where the person was stopped. Is that what we're talking about?
I think that's where it starts, and then the Cortana case takes that definition and begins to flesh it out a mile away. But I was not comfortable with 10 miles, and frankly, as I mentioned in my petition for review to this court, and again in my brief, I was satisfied with the Court of Appeals analysis on this issue. I think that that part of the opinion, in my view, was not something that I was going to appeal.
Mr. Perlman, I think Justice Prosser had a question.
The officer who made the stop, there were a number of officers, but the officer who made the stop of a moving automobile did not see any motor vehicle violations, as I understand.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. But the officer did have information based on statements by the driver's wife. She thought that he was trying to blow up their house, that he was possibly intoxicated, and it could be dangerous. But I want to take a side, it could be dangerous. Was there probable cause to stop the car for a criminal offense?
It was reasonable suspicion to stop the car to investigate the complaint by the wife, and that would be the motivation for that stop. At that point, there was certainly no probable cause of impairment. I don't think a wife saying he might be intoxicated with no other observations would be sufficient, but I believe that there was a reasonable suspicion based on the rather extreme circumstances that she described to make that stop. It would have been very, very tough to defend the cop from not
that. Wouldn't interpret that as a criminal offense that she talked about?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry. Yes, I would view all those offenses that she was discussing could be potentially criminal.
Do we have a 911 tape here?
I'm not aware of that. The way it was communicated in the record is that the wife called dispatch, clearly identified herself. This isn't an anonymous complaint. And dispatch notified Deputy Nicias, who responded.
You
described the van with specificity. So there was a legitimacy to the stop as well, that she knew she had that he knew he had the right vehicle.
Okay, now let's lay the cards on the table here. You talk about reasonable suspicion. I'm fishing for probable cause. And the alternative to probable cause, it seems to me, is that you want to go on community caretaker, which I am sometimes uncomfortable. Okay, so are you saying there was no probable cause here for the officer to stop that vehicle after getting all the information in that call and against the defendant's background?
I'm saying this, and I would put it in this form of equation. Reasonable suspicion justified the stop. The defendant's conduct and the officer's observations changed, as reasonable suspicion Terry stops often change, into probable cause for arrest.
Can I try again with what I think Justice Prosser's trying to ask you?
Yes.
Reasonable suspicion, no question. He could stop this car, I think. Justice Prosser's asking you, could he have just stopped the car and arrested him for the things that the wife said he did at home without getting to the .02 and the alcohol and all that, for threatening to blow up the home, or the other actions that she said he took at the home? Could they have just stopped him and arrested him for those things? And why aren't you arguing that?
You know, when I hear you say that, I'm asking myself why I didn't argue that. My feeling is that more information needed to be derived. This is a complaint. It is the wife. The complaints itself, if you look at them, are still hard to put your hands around. He's trying to blow up the house. He's doing this. He's doing that. You're making contact with the subject. But I did not make that argument because I felt that there was the way the case came down and the way the officer approached it and the way the officer testified to it is he wanted to see what was going on. He had heard the complainant. It's unusual. He wanted to see what was coming on. And as things developed, it became clear to him, in my opinion, that he had probable cause to arrest him just for the driving infraction, and he also had certainly a community caretaker concern as well, rather than the exploration. And ultimately, since the defendant was never arrested for those charges, the defendant never faced bail or anything on those charges, I did not pursue a probable cause analysis on them.
I think that was...
Yes, I think that... I now appreciate the question. And
is there any suggestion that these representations from the wife were not true?
The record does not discuss that, but I would gather, since there was no such charges, that it did not develop that the police or the prosecutors felt they had enough to proceed on those allegations.
Counsel, in discussing probable cause for the arrest, you indicated that before the transport, the police knew of third offense violation. You also listed the odor of intoxicant, watery eyes, the wife saying he may be intoxicated or might be intoxicated, the lack of response to police, inappropriate dress are some of the things you listed for probable cause to arrest. My sense is that you could make that same argument for probable cause to arrest with regard to .08 as well as .02. I think that we took this case in part to develop and clarify the law regarding the probable cause necessary to arrest a person for a PAC violation when the threshold level is 0.02. So, do you agree or disagree that what you listed is sufficient for probable cause for 0.08? And if not, tell me the difference between the threshold necessary for probable cause of 0.08 and 0.02.
Your Honor, let me answer that question first by asking myself a question and answering it. I think that will be illustrative. Oftentimes, this Court, and wisely, asks a litigant, how would you like this opinion to read? And from the State's point of view, I have three optimistic options: the silver package, the gold package, and the platinum package. The silver package is that the court reverses the Court of Appeals and holds there was probable cause to arrest above 0.02 for the variety of factors I list, which are more than just odor. The gold package is that you endorse the officer's conduct, both for the probable cause to arrest and the community caretaker. But the platinum package, and I will concede, this is something I want this Court to address, and I thought this might be something that the Court would be interested in addressing, is that even if I did, rather than say that was enough factors for a 0.08, and I would argue probably not, with a 0.08, I would be wondering why there were no field sobriety tests, no admission of drinking. It certainly was not as fleshed out an investigation as we would prefer in an 08 context. But this platinum package is this Court to provide the direction to the police and to reflect the legislative intent, which I think is remarkably transparent in this area, that a person who is a fourth offender, who is a 0.02 threshold, should not drink and drive, period. And that odor, which is not particularly probative as to how much somebody has been drinking, is very determinative that somebody has been drinking in the first place. And if anybody has been drinking, a person with three priors has been drinking, you have probable cause, just by that odor, that that person is above the PAC of 0.02 and should make the arrest. So you are correct that that is something that I'm asking this Court to do, but there are other factors here that could be added to it if the Court felt the need not to address that.
So you're asserting that with a multiple violator like this person,
yes,
and with the odor of alcohol on the person's breath, that as a matter of law, would be sufficient to establish probable cause necessary to arrest in a 0.02?
I am asking the Court to do that, yes.
And then as a result of that, you can order a blood test whether or not he likes it.
Right. You would go through the implied consent, and then he would go through the test. Now, one of the things that the defense raised in brief and is a question that's out there is, Dave, I didn't say Dave, but Dave, why didn't the legislature make it absolute sobriety? Your request is more consistent with absolute sobriety.
That was the question I was asking myself, by the way. I mean, since...
All right, so let's...
Asking,
yeah. Well, that makes me feel good.
Good.
Although I don't...
First time,
can you tell me your answer as well?
I'll wait for your answer. Go ahead.
But in my view, the distinction between absolute sobriety and the 0.02, and I don't know why the legislature did that. I've heard anecdotal things, but I hesitate to bring them up because I don't have a record site or something for that. But my feeling is that the distinction between 0.02 and absolute sobriety is completely de minimis in a probable cause analysis, but it would come up in a guilt and innocence analysis. That almost every single person who's been drinking, you've got your 0.02, but if it comes out at court and trial that he's 0.016, well, then he will prevail, and that's where the distinction is, not in the probable cause analysis. Now, I also read a footnote in the defendant's brief that suggested that one drink, it's possible to have one drink and be less than 0.02. I would be amazed if the legislature was really thinking that way. If the legislature was saying to a fourth offender, you can have one drink on us, But just make sure it's a small drink so it slides slightly under the .02. So I don't think that's it. I think any evidence of drinking is probable cause to arrest. It's a low threshold. It's a tough statute. But people are not anointed with the .02 threshold. They have earned it either through dramatic bad behavior, scoring above .15 and getting an IID, or refusing and getting an IID, or consistent and persistent lawless behavior, driving three previous times and getting three prior OWI convictions.
Mr. Perlman, don't you think that your platinum approach here has pretty well been taken care of by a case called State versus Goss that we decided about 3.5 years ago?
Yes, I remember State v. Goss, and that was a nice team. Your Honor wrote, and I argued. So, but in State v. Goss, the issue was odor enough for a PBT? And the court held, I think unanimous court, held that it was. And I'm stretching that further. In my briefing in Goss, I argued, although I didn't argue it at oral argument because I didn't have to, that I would think that odor would be enough even for probable cause, making the point it was enough for that. It certainly is enough for the PBT. But I can't say Goss stands for that principle because Goss was what you need for a PBT. But I think it's a natural extension to go as far as to the probable cause, and I think it's consistent with a rather transparent legislative intent here on a fourth offender.
You talked about getting a blood test.
Yes, Your Honor.
Don't we have McNeely now?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
So, and a warrant is going to be required.
In the event of a refusal. So exactly. What would happen is, on the .02, on the odor, in my scenario, he would be arrested. He'd be read implied consent. If he blew or submitted to a test, then there we are. If he was to refuse, then you would have to go and get a McNeely warrant, a search warrant, which probably wouldn't be hard to get.
So when you get that search warrant,
yes,
odor in the platinum test is going to be enough.
Well, in the platinum test, I would advise the court that he has the prior offenses, and then that he has the odor, and therefore it is a very strong likelihood that there would be evidence in the blood that would support that arrest. Yes. But when I say odor by itself, it's never really by itself. Number one, it's going to be connected with his prior record. And number two, this court in State v. Lange held, among other things, it held that a person's prior record, while not incredibly probative, is a legitimate factor in the formulation of probable cause. So in this case, the person would have his prior record, which is one factor, which is always going to be accompanying the odor because his threshold is .02. So you would get this will not excuse the McNeely doctrine of the search warrant. No. No, absolutely not. But I think that it's a search warrant that they could get. There's something I want to also kind of nip in the bud here, if I can. I don't mean to speak for Mr. Blatterman, but both at trial and at briefing, there was some discussion about the second versus third offense. During testimony, Deputy Nisius said on direct examination, two prior, and then immediately corrected himself, or three prior convictions. And somehow that been interpreted that he didn't know. The court held that he did know. I think that that is a finding of fact. I think that is reasonable, and considering that his driving record showed he had three priors, I think that is a reasonable conclusion on that. Now, moving to the community caretaker analysis, this is a case, that issue that this court has dealt with.
Mr. Perlman, you have your red light's on. I'll give you a couple of minutes, but then you'll have to do caretaker.
Okay. Well, you know, community caretaker, all I just want to say is that many of the factors that were listed in the OWI also support his community caretaker doctrine. His behavior was consistent with the community caretaker approach, as is evidenced by the fact that when he arrived at the hospital, first he had the medical concerns addressed before, once those were ameliorated completely, he switched gears and went for the OWI processing.
So did the caretaker function, did it start out as a caretaker, or did it switch to caretaker at some time?
I think it became a care. It started out as really, as the Justice Prosser or Justice Eagler suggests, as an investigation of serious and possibly dangerous offenses. It morphed into some caretaker because of the way he was dressed, because of his odd, erratic behavior, because he complained of chest pain, and it morphed into that as well. There was a lot of focus for the police officer here to deal with, something the Court of Appeals did mention in its opinion before it basically dismissed it.
Thank you, counsel. For Mr. Blatterman.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Attorney Perlman. My name is Jonas Bednarik. I represent Dean Blatterman, a representative in the trial court through the Court of Appeals and now here. The analysis that I've gone through in my head in this case is that given the state's concession that the transport of Mr. Blatterman violated both 968.24 and Cortana, that I agree with Mr. Perlman, there are only two possible legal justifications for what happened. The first is that there's probable cause to arrest Mr. Blatterman prior to the transport. The second is sort of this afterthought that didn't get ferreted out in the trial court, but is now being addressed to you in this court, is that community caretaker theory would also support this transport. So I think I want to address each of those potential bits of support for this arrest in order. So I'll start with the lack of probable cause to arrest. Justice Crooks, you, I think, aptly noted that your opinion in Goss would effectively be eviscerated by the state's suggestion today that this odor amounts on an O2 standard to probable cause to arrest. Goss is rendered, in my opinion, entirely meaningless should we adopt such a rule. But I have to point out, and I think Attorney Perlman recognized this when he spoke to you, that I am not comfortable in deeming this a .02 case. The record in this case, the Deputy Nicias was asked when he ran Mr. Blatterman's driver's record, which is Justice Abrahamson, after he'd been placed in the squad car and in handcuffs, and frankly, after I think EMS had been called and then released. He testified at the trial court that he had two or three prior convictions. That was on direct examination by the state. I then clarified that when I cross-examined the officer and I asked him when you ran his record and saw two prior convictions, and he ratified that. I am not at all confident that we are dealing with an officer that believed this to be a .02 standard. And so when we discuss the probable cause requirements, it's very much tied in to what legal standard is Mr. Blatterman laboring under, an O2 or an O8 standard.
That may be true, but isn't it an objective standard, not a subjective standard, whether there's probable cause?
Correct, but he has to know what he's arresting him for. I mean, Justice Abrahamson, he did not have probable cause to arrest him for an impaired driving offense, okay? I mean, there is nothing about this case that suggests that Mr. Blatterman was physically impaired. His driving was flawless. He didn't exhibit any indicia of intoxication as he exited the vehicle. He didn't have balance problems. He didn't exhibit slurred speech or the typical factors that we associate with impairment. This is not an impaired driving investigation. This, to me, was an investigation as to whether or not he was operating in a prohibited alcohol capacity. So when the officer is calculating as to whether or not he has probable cause for that, I think it's very much important to know what legal standard this officer is operating under. And it's different. An 08 and an 02 is obviously considerably different.
You know, it's not unusual for the community caretaker function of law enforcement to be intertwined factually and subjectively with the officer. And that's why, as the Chief Justice observed, in the context of probable cause, we have an objective standard. We also have an objective standard, as you know, for community caretaker. And so you gave sort of an edited version of what happened after your client was pulled over. Don't we also have to consider the totality of the circumstances, which would include his wife's call in regard to what he was attempting to do at the house? Wouldn't we also have to include the T-shirt and jeans and the freezing weather in March? Wouldn't we also have to include his failure to obey the law enforcement officer's directive to stay within the vehicle? And wouldn't we also have to consider his failure to obey the law enforcement officer's order to basically turn around so that, you know, his back would be to the officer? But he didn't do any of those things.
The assessment is clearly done in a totality capacity. So absolutely we look at the totality of the facts, and that cannot be disputed. What I can say is that, and you listed a number of facts, I can say that the concerns that his spouse expressed, at least to dispatch, that were then relayed to Deputy Nicias as he...
Which included, I'm sorry to interrupt, which included, as long as we're having the discussion, the prior comment, at some unknown time, as far as I know, does the record disclose when the allegation about suicide by cop was made?
The allegation of suicide by cop was actually not... The record doesn't show that that was made by his wife. That was something that dispatch, I believe, relayed to the officer, okay? So it's not clear as to whether or not that information was gleaned from his spouse or from other sources.
And I phrased my question ambiguously. I should have asked, was there any indication that the officer had knowledge as to when Mr. Blatterman had made that?
None. None. Okay. And I think, and I'm going to get back to the totality in a second, but one of the problems that I have with this community caretaker argument that the state is forcing on us in this case is that, and your question points it out, these were not facts that were ferreted out at the trial court because this is not something that they argued at the trial court. So in some respects, we are left in sort of a factual vacuum as far as the record goes when we're asked to apply community caretaker theory to this situation. They're clearly, I mean, that is clearly something that one would want to know if you're assessing the viability or whether or not the community caretaker procedure was bona fide, I guess is what I'm trying to say, is we'd want more facts, we'd want more information. And that's not something that happened at the trial court. And I think your question then recognizes that. But moving back to your comments, Justice Gableman, about the totality and the facts known to this officer, the other thing that the record reflects in this case is that Deputy Nicias was not the only dispatched officer. He was being dispatched to the scene, the home where the call originated. And as he was being dispatched, the record reflects that he was updated that this individual had left in a white minivan with Anna 922 or something, the license plate number. So he then sees the van traveling in the other direction. Now, there are other officers that are heading to the home at the same time. And Deputy Nicias, at the hearing in this case, at the trial court, told us about, at least to some level, the communication between himself and the officers at the scene. And what he was told was that we don't have anything to arrest Mr. Blatterman on from the home. Okay? So when we talk about the wife communicating what she communicated and how that fits into the totality, we also have to remember that that information was largely dispelled during the course of the roadside investigation by Deputy Nicias through information provided to him by officers at the scene.
Which would have been something along the lines of we didn't find any physical corroboration.
I think the record says we don't have anything to arrest him on from the home.
Okay.
And I don't believe it was further elaborated on beyond that.
Okay.
When we look at, and obviously you point out that it's totality, there are other factors as well in this totality analysis. Because of Deputy Nicias's concern for his safety, and he testifies that he's conducting a high-risk felony stop, He followed Mr. Blatterman for about 8 minutes, I think that's what the testimony was, waiting for reinforcement officers to show up. In that time, the record reflects that there was no driving violations whatsoever. I think he traveled through several intersections, through some roundabouts, and there was no driving violations at all. So that seems to undermine any concerns or any allegations by his spouse that he's possibly intoxicated, because he's not exhibiting any indicia of intoxication whatsoever. That was further strengthened by the observations of the officer at the scene then. He didn't, I'll grant you that he was a little bit, I have to choose my words carefully, but he was not exactly compliant with the officer's commands at first blush, okay? But then there's nothing beyond that to suggest that he wasn't in any way compliant. He was forced to the ground, he complained of chest pain, EMS was called, and he then said, no, I'm okay, I don't need EMS. It's at this point that the officer then does nothing but transport him to the hospital, and on the way says, I think I'm going to need a phlebotomist. That's not community caretaker, and that's not probable cause either. Look, what this court needs to do is it needs to provide guidance to the police officers on the side of the road in these situations. And what Deputy Nicias should have done is the most basic thing a law enforcement officer should do every time. Ask some questions. Have you been drinking? Where have you been drinking? When have you been drinking? I understand that you have been putting gas in the house. Is that true? None of this happened. There wasn't even one iota of questioning of Mr. Blatterman. He was forced to the ground, he was handcuffed, and he was put in the back of the squad car. Some time went by while EMS arrived. He said, I'm okay, I don't need any EMS. And the officer says, let's go to the hospital. More than questioning, he could have asked him to do the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. I mean, that's the first field sobriety test that I generally see.
Sir, but if you're just looking at a PAC, which is what you started out your argument with informing us about, not looking at impairment, I'm not sure how what you're telling us now all ties together, because opposing counsel said that before he transported Mr. Blatterman to the hospital, he was told that he had 3 priors. So it must have come over the radio in the squad or however they get it. Maybe they have a visual computer. So he had that knowledge before he decided to take him to the hospital. And he smells like alcohol and his eyes are watery. You know, probable cause isn't certainty. Probable cause is what it says. Probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and the defendant likely did it. So I don't see how, when you're looking at a PAC and you know the threshold is 0.02, why there isn't probable cause at that point in time, given his physical observations.
Two-part answer to that question. Part one is I would not agree that this officer knew there were 3 prior convictions. I don't think the record supports that. He was not told there were 3 prior convictions. The record supports that he was told there were 2 or 3 prior convictions. And then I asked him again on cross-examination, when you learned of 2, and he ratified 2. So I would not in any way concede that this officer knew Mr. Blatterman was subject to that 0.02 standard.
Okay, I'll look at the record. I haven't gone fly-specking it for that question, but I surely will.
Does the record show that he was convicted of 3? Is there anything in the record that shows he was convicted of 3 offenses?
No. I guess I'd have to think back to know if they attached. Usually what happens is driver's records are attached to the criminal complaints.
And that's my point.
Yeah, uh-huh. And I honestly, Chief Justice, I don't remember if that's the case.
Well, it's in the factual section of the criminal complaint. They have to make the allegations so you know it's a 4th offense and there's probable cause for it.
But
it's in the.
And I believe that to be true, yeah. Of course, to support PC in a complaint, you would need to include the priors.
No, but the complaint is sometime after. It's not on the road. So if he would know it when the complaint was filed, the police officers would. But the question is there anything in the record that shows during the arrest or during his custody, may or may not be arrested sometime, and his transport to the hospital. Is anything that that indicates or states that there were three violations? I mean, you're resting on that, aren't you?
No, not entirely. I don't think there's probable cause to arrest on an O2 violation either.
Well, it's not an O2 violation unless there are three.
Right.
Okay, so that's your first step. Then you're going to say, even if there are three arrests and it's O2, then you're going to tell us, I hope, what it takes to arrest for O2.
It takes more than what we have here. To arrest on an O2, and that's what I was alluding to with what should have this officer done. Clearly, Goss gives him the ability to ask Mr. Blatterman to submit to a preliminary breath test. That's fast. That's easy. That's something that could have been done while he was handcuffed in the back of the squad car. It doesn't impeach officer safety concerns. And frankly, that's exactly what this court told the officer to do in Goss. But again, I think even before the preliminary breath test, I think Mr. Blatterman properly should have been questioned. And it didn't. There's nothing in this record at all to show that he was questioned about any of this. I think we went straight from the felony high-risk stop and arrest at the side of the road there to the hospital without any intervening police work.
And at that first point, the stop, do I infer from your responses to the last two or three questions that you agree the initial stop was justified?
I filed a motion in the trial court that I thought was my best motion. I don't believe it necessarily is valid. I filed what I thought was a good motion in the trial court. The tip that came in was an identified tip that seemed to contain inside information. So that would tend to indicate that allows for reasonable suspicion on a stop. I did not fully examine that issue, Justice Gableman, to know as to whether or not that stop was legitimate legally. So without saying it was, I won't concede that it was, but for purposes of what we're here for today,
okay,
we can operate on that.
So when did the officer, in your estimation, when did it become wrongful? The behavior. You know, you suggested certain things that he could have done in addition under the circumstances, but just as Mr. Perlman was questioned to identify when exactly was he arrested, which of course is a legitimate necessary inquiry, I ask you at what point did the legitimate stop for the purposes of what we're here for today transform itself into inappropriate detention.
And really, if I phrase it this way, it's when did a Terry stop become an arrest? At what point?
But the nice thing about this job is I get to ask the questions and you have to answer them.
Unless you're Mr. Perlman, then apparently he has the question.
So, Justice Gableman, the situation on the side of the road was heated. This man had three, maybe four guns drawn on him. He was asked to exit a vehicle under commanding tones with three identified squad cars with the red and blues going.
Do I recollect some confusion about whether he had an object in his hand?
There wasn't confusion. In his right hand, he had his cell phone, and Deputy Nissa said, I recognized it to be a cell phone. So my belief is he was probably arrested very shortly thereafter because he was forced to the ground, handcuffed, and escorted to the back of a locked squad car. I asked Deputy Nissius how that was, and sure, he was placed in the back of the squad car. You can't open those doors from the inside.
Sure, but aren't the law enforcement officers are allowed a reasonable period of time to conduct a reasonable investigatory stop to determine the status quo?
Absolutely. He didn't do that. I mean, after Mr. Blatterman is in the back of the squad car, there's no investigation, and that's my point. There was no additional investigation done. The only thing that Deputy Nissius learned was that there was not probable cause to arrest him from anything that happened at the house. And that is my point, where this court needs to send a message to the law enforcement. You need to take these investigative steps that were not taken here. He easily could have been questioned. And I think that's my hang-up on this case, is you say, well, at what point? Nothing happened. When those handcuffs went on and he went back into the squad car, nothing happened to further the investigation.
But you see, with the objective standard for both, and I guess I am a little more friendly to community care, the idea of community caretaker, not just, not talking about this case, but in general. And we know that in hindsight. We know that in hindsight, here we are in this nice room so much time later, and we know nothing happened. But the standard that we're to apply for community caretaker is not the subjective thought of the officer. So it doesn't even matter from a legal standpoint if that officer thought that he was investigating and arresting for criminal conduct. We, our job is to determine what would a reasonable officer under the same or similar circumstances would have done, and if so, did it comport with community caretaker? And it seems to me some of the factors that you've just outlined, and you described it as a heated, I would say a very charged, if any of us were there in the officer's role, I don't think it takes too great of a concession to say, we'd be concerned for our safety.
The concerns for officer safety, two things. First off, I do believe that the subjective intent of the officer is relevant in a community caretaker analysis. And I think that's what this court held in State versus Kramer. I think that in that case, when addressing a community caretaker analysis, the subjective intent of the officer can be relevant. And I believe, Justice Rogenczyk, that you wrote Kramer, and maybe I'm misreading it. But apart from that, to address your concern, Justice Gableman, about the safety of the officer, this individual could not possibly pose a risk to this officer under these circumstances after he was put in handcuffs. He was completely disabled at that point. He was handcuffed in the back of a locked squad car. He was patted down. He had no weapons. The officer's concerns for his safety.
But the only reason that was done was in response. Isn't that a logical response to his conduct after getting out of the vehicle?
Perhaps it was, but that doesn't implicate a community caretaker transport. I mean, look.
Now you're changing the transport. You started with the handcuffs.
I understand, but to me these areas kind of mesh together at some level. Could this officer take him in a Terry stop setting for his safety? Yes, and he did, and I think he rightfully did. And the pat-down was legitimate because of that. The temporary questioning, if there was any in this case, is permissible under Terry. But this evolved to far beyond a Terry stop. I mean, we've now transformed into a full-blown arrest. And it's bridging that gap between the Terry stop and the arrest that required additional facts.
Do you agree with Mr. Perlman that the arrest occurred when he was transported by the EMS officers?
No, I think it occurred prior to that.
When?
I think it occurred when he was taken to the ground and handcuffed and escorted to the back of a locked squad car.
Counsel, could I ask you about the .02 again? What, if anything, should we do with the trial court's determination that this was a .02 case, meaning he had the requisite number of offenses? Otherwise, it's not a .02 case.
What this court needs to do is it needs to take Goss to the next step and say to arrest on a .02 case, you need more than just a mere odor. You need to do what police do. And
my question's a little different. I hear you. My question is, do we owe any deference to that trial court determination on that issue? Because I hear you today saying it's really not clear, if you look at the record, whether this is three priors or two priors or where we are, if it's a .08 or a .02 case or where we are on the spectrum. But then I look at what the trial court said, and the trial court clearly analyzed this in terms of a .02, meaning the trial court must have,
right,
analyzing your motion, it said this is a .02 case, meaning there are the requisite number of offenses.
Understood. That would require this court to believe that the finding of the trial court was erroneous on that issue.
Okay.
There are other, frankly, erroneous trial court findings. I mean, the trial court, the testimony was
you agree it's a clearly erroneous standard?
Yes, I would.
That was kind of just all I was getting at. I was sure.
And just to bolster that, I guess, in my client's defense here, is that there are other erroneous factual findings made by the trial court. The officer described an odor of intoxicants and watery eyes. By the end of the ruling, that had transformed into bloodshot, strong odor, and various other things. So there were clearly erroneous factual findings, and I believe that the number of priors was erroneous as well, to answer your question.
Thank you.
Counsel, looking at the record, and this is a follow-up to Justice Ziegler's question, it appears that on the day in question, March 19, 2013, that two citations were issued. The document in the record reflects that the citations were served in person on March 19, 2013. And the citations are operating while under the influence fourth. And the second one is for operating with PAC fourth. Now, the complaint, understandably, wasn't filed until almost, until the next month sometime. That is, the complaint was filed on April 12, 2013, with the attached driving record. But of what moment is it that the citation, which was personally served on the date of the offense, contains the charge of OWI fourth and the PAC charge fourth? At what moment is that to your argument that the officer really wasn't quite sure if there were two or three offenses?
Well, it clearly indicates that he wasn't sure, because he's also arresting him, or at least citing him, for operating while impaired. I mean, that's what an intoxicated offense is, that he can't safely operate the motor vehicle.
I'm looking at the number four, and that's my focus. You advance the argument the officer was not sure. During testimony, he said two or three, that in your cross you asked two, and he affirmed that in some way. But the citation is clearly for the fourth on the day in question.
And the record doesn't have anything about this, so I would have to speculate. But knowing how officers do this, and I do a lot of OWI work in the trial court, the citation that you're looking at is something that the officer generates usually in the squad car with the computer in the squad car. And it's after all of everything else has been done. The suspect is in jail or otherwise in custody, and the information is entered, and then the documents are presented. So my suspicion is that would have given the officer a great deal of time to take a look at his driver's record, because originally the driver's record was conveyed to him through dispatch. And I know that law enforcement has an ability to push the buttons on the onboard computer and actually pull a driver's record up at the side of the road. So I don't want to speculate as to whether or not he gathered strengthening information about the driver's record of Mr. Blatterman. It's entirely possible and frankly probable that that's what happened. But I don't know.
Is there a video of anything?
We filed a request for a video that's always in, and no, there was not. I don't believe a video. At least it's not part of the record if there was. I guess we're talking a great deal about the record in this case, and for obvious reasons. But I must go back to my concern about the fact that none of this community caretaker theory was advanced at that trial court, because I think we have a much better record if had that been done. Had we known exactly what the officer was thinking about his personal safety or the safety of others, that factors into that community caretaker calculus. And none of that was accomplished in this case, unfortunately. This is sort of the first time that we're really fleshing that out in sort of a scant evidentiary record, I believe. The only other comments I'll make very briefly before I conclude here is back to the probable cause analysis. The totality of the facts that Justice Gableman alludes to, and I talked a little bit about him, about his wife, and how that information was dispelled by the officers on the scene. The other thing is there's, in my opinion, there's a fact that cuts against every fact that Mr. Perlman outlined. This offense happened at 8:43 in the morning. That obviously is not a time typically associated with impaired driving offenses. There was, as I said, no signs of impairment other than perhaps at best an inability to follow the directions of the officer. I would ask that this court, in light of all of the facts and circumstances, uphold the Court of Appeals on this record and order that the Fourth Amendment prohibits this police conduct in this case. Thank you.
Counsel, are you your private counsel? You're not part of the Public Defender's Office, but are you hired through that or paid through the Public Defender's Office?
I'm not, no.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Perlman.
Thank you. Just some clarifications. First of all, Justice Gableman, you were questioning when the officer was aware about the knowledge of suicide by cop. The record is quite clear. He was aware of it before he even made the stop. That's why he, one of the reasons that he lists as his call for backup. So he was aware of that from the get-go. Secondly, this second or third issue. Here's the way it actually came down on the record. The officer testified, two prior, or three prior, immediate correction. Under cross-examination, defense counsel asked him something, and in his question, presumed it was two priors. I understand it's a little gamesmanship there. He said to the officer something, and that's after second violation, and the officer, I think focusing more on his general question, answered the question. I would hardly call that an endorsement that he thought that the guy did not have three priors. The trial court made a finding of fact, discussed this at length in the back and forth, even said to the defense counsel, I'm viewing it as three. Defense counsel said, rather cleverly, I'm a defense lawyer, I'm viewing it as two. But it was three, or at least the finding of three. I don't think there's any way that's clearly erroneous. The driving record is in the record, and it shows three priors.
Counselor, when you say the trial court made a finding there were three, did the trial court make a finding about knowledge of three at any particular
Yes, I think he, the trial court did by saying the officer misspoke. Excuse me, I pardon. The officer misspoke. He meant three. So, yes. Next issue, which
I'm,
is...
I'm sorry, I didn't phrase my question perhaps particularly well.
Yes, Your Honor.
When... Did the trial court make a finding about when the officer knew there were three?
Well, the officer testified that he got the driving record, and the officer testified that that's when the two prior or three prior came up, and that was before transport.
Okay. Thank you.
In my view,
did he,
yes,
in getting the driving record, did he get a printout or...
It was a printout that I saw in the record, and it showed that the three priors, admittedly, a while ago, occurred in, I think, 91 and 92, but they were clearly listed there. Another issue is Blatterman is arguing, or Attorney Mandarich is arguing, that in his view, the arrest occurred the moment he was handcuffed and put on the ground, and then on the other breath, he conceded that that was necessary for the safety of the officer. That is not when the arrest occurred. That was the initial contact with him. The arrest, in my view, occurred, and not even when the transport started, because a transport could still be justified under the Terry doctrine. It's when that transport went past what would be conceived to be the vicinity that we are now having conduct consistent with an arrest. Also, he claims there was no investigation. That's not true. There was plenty of investigation. Not of the PAC, but of the community caretaker concerned. They called for EMS. They asked him what was wrong with him. These are communications. The officer had a split focus here, and I think to his credit, prioritized the community caretaker at that moment over his own investigatory needs as well. So there was investigation. Again, we have here a .02. We have a .02 with odor, and there are other factors. I understand that this court, and frankly, it still would be, from the state's point of view, an acceptable option, might decide this case to, that the O2 was met and list factors above breath. I also believe there was a legitimate community caretaker emphasis here. But I also ask this court to consider, as I, cavalierly described the platinum package, that it is a good time to make clear to the police and to drivers that the legislative intent is for people with a 0.02 threshold to not in any way mix drinking with driving.
How can you really advance that? It seems to me you are advancing absolute sobriety. I mean, if they wanted absolute sobriety, that is the legislature, they would have said it. But they didn't. They said, a little bit's okay. A little bit's okay.
Maybe they said a little bit might not be a conviction, but when it's just a little bit, the probable cause analysis, in my view, any evidence of drinking would be met.
Mr. Perlman, my question had, and it's very brief, which is handy because your red light is on, and it's almost 11 when the fire alarm is going to go.
There are tremendous motivations for me to answer you quickly.
Quickly, isn't it? That was part of the purpose. You are smart. Now I forgot my question. No.
That was not my intent.
Is there any anything in the record to indicate the timing of when Mr. Blatterman had made the comment, not when the officer learned about that? I know that from the record. Is there anything in the record to indicate the time frame we're talking about when he said something about suicide by gun?
No. Okay. It says in the past.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman, and thank you, Mr. Bednarik, for your arguments today on, once again, probable cause when there's arrest and violation of the Fourth Amendment or any statute. So that concludes our hearing on 2013 AP 2107 CR, State versus Blatterman. There will be a siren. They test it the first Wednesday of every month, so it will go off. It's a very unpleasant noise. The students may leave when they wish, and we will not call the second case until these sirens are concluded. Thank you. We are in recess for a few moments.